This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. The first case of the Omicron variant in the United States was reported early last week in California. Since that report, the federal government has announced its plans to address the winter surge, variants, and vaccination needs. To learn more about the Omicron variant, we're joined now by Shandy Dirth, Director for the Center of Public Health Practice at IUPUI School of Public Health, and Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University. And just a reminder, if you're listening to this live right now and you have a pressing question or a comment or any of that stuff, make sure to give us a call at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881, or you can message us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Shandy, welcome to the program. Graham, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, although I would be happy to talk about something other than COVID at some point.
Yes. Well, let's start with the Omicron variant. Shandy, how was this found? For those who may not have been following all of the headlines that have been inundating our feeds.
So basically, really strong surveillance systems have been set up around the world to look for variants, because we know we still have a lot of transmission going on out there with COVID. And so scientists are constantly looking for mutations, for changes, for new variants. And this was found in South Africa first. And I just have to give kudos to South Africa, because they've been very transparent. They were out in the public right away. They went to WHO, World Health Organization, to do the report. And they've been very forthcoming and sharing information with the world so that we can all get on the same page at the same time and figure out what's going on with the new variant.
I think initially folks were saying that South Africa was being punished for being so transparent, because it's like almost immediately plans were put in place, maybe some travel restrictions going to go into effect. Was this a good response, Shandy?
So I can see the response needed to cut down the transmission as soon as possible. But, you know, it could be a situation where the cat might already be out of the bag. And I can say I can see the reason why some people think the reaction was that way, because it was South Africa. Would this have happened in London? You know, are we mm-hmm. really being equitable when we do some of these shutdowns in transportation? So I think we need to look at that across the board. I don't have a yes or no on that one, but I can definitely see the outcry and why that was there, about why everyone was so quick to shut down travel. And honestly, what we've seen now is that variant had been around for a few days, obviously, before it was reported, and we've seen how quickly it spread. And so that may have been, honestly, too little too late.
Right. And as more cases are being discovered, it makes me wonder if it's been around for a while, and maybe only South Africa was transparent enough to report it.
That's true. You know, this could have potentially started somewhere else, and they were the first ones to find it. Right now, we're just seeing so much of it there. There's a good chance that it could have started there. Again, it's just not definitive. Mm-hmm. Same thing, where we don't have definitive answers on exactly where COVID started the very first time.
Right. Well, Graham, how are variants formed?
Well, you know, viruses mutate all the time, and some of the mutations aren't beneficial to the virus, but sometimes they are, and that's exactly what viruses want to do. They want to survive and replicate. And so they pick those up over time. And we think, you know, in a couple cases of these more better known variants, one, I think we're realizing that coronaviruses probably mutate a little bit more frequently than we thought they were, or at least they do when we have a global pandemic and this much spread occurring. Excuse me. But with some of these particular variants, it's very likely that they actually manifested in just a single immunocompromised individual that couldn't kick that infection and had a persistent infection over time. And so, you know, with Delta, which is highly contagious and still raging here in the U.S. and Indiana, that particular variant has 9 mutations on the spike protein. Of course, the spike protein is what can identify and latch on and enter our human cells. And so that one's very important. And with Omicron, it has 32 mutations just on that spike protein alone. And so some of those are more concerning based on what we already know. A lot of them we don't know much about. It even shares some genetic code with some of the common cold coronaviruses as well. And then maybe that makes it really adapt to human hosts, and potentially why it's more maybe going to be more transmissible on Delta. It certainly appears that way based on the surface of the information we have so far. But I think it also goes to show, really, with this push that we need for global health equity, for vaccine equity, because you know, if there are pockets of the world that are going to remain unvaccinated for some amount of time, that puts everybody else at risk. And, you know, it's retrospective, of course, but, you know, we could have really spent the last year pushing out more vaccines globally to reduce the chance of these type of things occurring.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the cold virus, and I was just thinking about since it's a version, it's a coronavirus, correct? It's one of the many forms of it.
It's a lot of different viruses, yes, but there are several human coronaviruses that can cause illness in humans, and a couple of those are basically your common cold.
Mm-hmm. Do you think folks or scientists are able to find things for the common cold with the research that they're doing for COVID?
I would think so. I would hope so. But, you know, it also mutates rather frequently. And then we don't tend to have a lot of long-term immunity with a lot of the common cold viruses. And I think, you know, I think we knew that generally with coronaviruses before the pandemic. And I think that's why we're seeing that kind of marked waning immunity, either after natural infection or vaccine-induced immunity.
Shandy, what do we know about the cases of Omicron right now in the U.S.?
So at this point, we're up to 17 states reporting cases around the U.S. Many of those cases still have some sort of connection to travel to South Africa. So we don't see widespread transmission yet here in the U.S., but within another week or two, that could be a very different situation. As Graham said, right now, this is looking possibly even more infectious, more transmissible than Delta, which we know has already hit us really hard. And so we're really expecting to see more and more cases reported here in the U.S. that don't have any travel history in the coming days.
Well, Graham, how is the process or what is the process of finding variants? I'm just imagining if folks aren't getting tested, how would we know if it's out there?
That's a great point. And, you know, a year ago, we were not doing really much surveillance at all or enough to be proactive or preventative, I would say. And I think in the last year, we've gotten better. It's probably four or five times as many as we were sequencing last year, but it's still pretty low. Now, the way that we have the surveillance set up nationally, it should pick up things pretty quickly. It's just kind of sporadic in different areas of the country. But other countries like South Africa, as we've seen, have much more robust surveillance systems in place. The UK does a lot more sequencing than we do, for example, as well. But I think if there's one little blessing, at least with this variant that we know already, is a lot of these viruses have specific gene markers. And if we remember back to the spring, we had Alpha here, the UK variant, B1117. And that specific variant, you could actually detect through a general PCR test. It has a certain S gene, a spike protein dropout that the PCR tests look for. They look for a few different gene markers. And so if that one dropped out, but you still had the others there, that would still be a positive result. But that would tell us essentially at that time that that was Alpha. Well, Delta does not have that dropout, but Omicron does. So we can actually detect this in PCR testing if you're using the certain test kits without sequencing. And so that we've kind of already informed our labs at the university to look out for that as a potential early indicator. And then if we do see that, we can send it along for further sequencing.
That's interesting. Chandy, what do we know about Omicron so far? I know it's probably still too early to get much information, but when it compares to Delta, you know, there's just so much information out there that seems to contradict each other. What is something that maybe we know for sure right now?
So it's still very early on in the game on this one. What we do know from South Africa, they actually just released a very snapshot report on Friday. It showed us that a lot of the cases they found, they actually found because of their surveillance. So there, many of the hospitalized cases they looked at are there for other reasons, not for COVID, which is great, which tells us, though, that even among some vaccinated people, it has spread, but it hasn't caused a lot of illness. So right now, in the very small numbers that we've seen reported, it looks mild. And so perhaps this could be more contagious than Delta, but more mild, which would be great for us. Again, it's still very early. CDC is saying we probably need 2 to 4 weeks of data to make some more definitive remarks about things such as how effective our current vaccines are, how transmissible it really is, if there are certain populations more at risk than others, that sort of thing. But honestly, at this point here in the U.S., I'm still much more concerned about the Delta that we have here versus the Omicron that we're going to be getting possibly.
Graham, do you think we should be worried at all about Omicron at this point?
Well, yeah, I think we got to, at this point, it's, you know, the precautionary principle, right? As Shandy just said, we need another week to 4 weeks of data to really know. And even if it is more mild, generally, mild can still have, you know, unwanted outcomes. And severe outcomes aren't the only outcomes either. We still obviously don't know anything about Omicron, the potential for long COVID as well. So I think there's a lot yet to be seen. And, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, this path to making COVID endemic at some point. And what we're seeing right now is not it. We're not there. And this, in a way, could maybe make that longer. Because, you know, to get to an endemic disease, you basically need everybody infected or vaccinated. And if this evades natural immunity, if we call it that, or infection-induced immunity or vaccine-induced immunity, that could take a little bit longer to get there. Now, if it's less severe, like we may think, then maybe that's a good thing. And that's kind of a bridge to getting us to a more manageable, more predictable virus. But I think we all can say that, you know, we really shouldn't look to the crystal ball too much and try to make too many predictions, because we've seen this virus behave in ways that are really quite unpredictable so far.
Well, Shandy, we're going to go to break, but before we do, how many cases of COVID are Delta right now in the U.S., percentage-wise, do you think?
So it's still the dominant by far, so, you know, high 90%. And again, that could change in the coming weeks, depending on how transmissible it is. But it's really hard to predict that right now until we have more information about this new variant.
Well, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about vaccines and how those can be helpful and whether we're seeing that as a way to fight back against some of these variants that are popping up. We'll be back after a quick break. We're getting updates on the Omicron and Delta variants and plans to fight COVID spread this winter. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Shandy Dirth, Director of the Center for Public Health Practice at IUPUI School of Public Health, and Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. The first case of the Omicron variant in the U.S. was found early last week in California. Since then, more cases have been found in states across the country. Also last week, the federal government announced their plans to address the spread of the Omicron and Delta variants, as well as battle a potential winter surge. We're joined by Shandy Dirth, Director of the Center for Public Health Practice at IUPUI School of Public Health, and Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University, to talk about this topic from different angles. And before the break, we were teasing about the vaccines and how that impacts everything. Graham, do you think we could be seeing breakthrough cases because the vaccine is wearing off?
Yeah, I think it's a host of reasons of why we're seeing some breakthrough infections, which, again, still tend to be more mild. And we don't see as much breakthrough transmission in most settings. It does seem to be higher in a household setting, but I think that makes sense from your exposure risk. But that's why, you know, it took some time, I think, for the data to be there to really convince some of us for the need for boosters. But I say it is there now. And then anecdotally, I think we're seeing it, too, in our case counts and our case review. And so, you know, I'd say if you're 6 months out from an mRNA vaccine or 2 months out from your J&J, now is the time to get that booster before the holidays. And so I think it's a combination of, you know, waning over time. I think it's a little bit of it has to do with Delta. The mutations were a little bit more selective in their ability to evade protection from symptomatic infection. But they're still incredibly good against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And I assume that we could probably extend that to Omicron as well. And if it's also less severe, then all the better. But no, I think that's definitely what we're seeing, and definitely the time to go out and get that extra shot.
Shandy, for folks who are vaccine hesitant, do you think that with new variants coming out and the potential that vaccines may not cover those variants creates more of a hesitancy in these folks who are like, see, I'm not going to get it. It doesn't work.
So I think we're far enough at this point that the people who don't want to get it are just adamant that no matter what, they don't want to get the vaccine. And I think that's where it takes a one-on-one conversation with that person's physician, a family friend, a close relative who can really explain the situation. Or sometimes it will take someone losing someone close to COVID before they really recognize that this is real and it really could happen to them, unfortunately. And so I don't know if this variant would actually push that group over the edge. I think a lot of times it takes that more personal connection, that story, to really get someone to change their minds at this point.
Graham, what are your thoughts on the same question?
Very similar thoughts. I think we are seeing vaccinations increase, but a lot of that I think are already in the vaccinated or those that are more public health conscious. Can't agree enough that, you know, at this point in the game, having been available for a year, if you're not vaccinated, the likelihood of you getting vaccinated is going to be pretty slim unless you have something that kind of that Shandy did have described. I think it's going to be a real challenge. And we don't like mandates, or at least I don't like mandates in public health. You know, I really want people to know enough to do the right thing that's in their best interest and the interest of others and population health. But clearly people do not know or understand that. And, mandates do work. They at least work in getting levels up in the usually the 90s, low 90s or mid 90s in terms of the percentage of people vaccinated. That's not 100%. And I think even, having a slight with, a variant or a virus this contagious, even having, 85% level, could, as we see in some of these countries, can still result in spread. And so I think that's really the ultimate path that should be taken. But, unfortunately, I think the politics surrounding COVID and the vaccinations and the courts essentially holding up these executive orders is kind of putting a stop to that. But fully agree that they are absolutely essential.
I think it's South Africa now that's seeing an increase in folks going to get the vaccine due to Omicron. Shandy, is that something that we could possibly see here in the U.S.?
I mean, I think we could see a bit of that, but honestly, I think most of what we're going to see is because of the mandates that are coming up. So I think people are getting to that point where they're just going to go ahead and cave and do it because their job is making them do it. Which, as Graham said, we try and do education first. But as we've seen in public health over many decades, sometimes you have to do the mandate. That's how we have the seatbelt laws. That's why we have the rules around indoor smoking now around the state and many other states in the U.S. because we tried to do a lot of education, but it really took that mandate to make some of those things stick. And unfortunately, it looks like that is where we have to go with COVID vaccinations as well. And we've done that with other vaccinations in the past. I mean, that's why we don't have rampant polio and, other diseases like that here among our K-12 kids on a regular basis. It's because we've had those mandates over the years and they worked.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to the populations of folks still not getting vaccinated, is it primarily younger groups or is it a mix?
You know, it's definitely a mix. We've definitely seen some higher vaccination rates in some of the urban areas. But, some of the rural areas in Indiana have really popped up in the recent months, too, which is great. Another area of concern is pregnant women. Pregnant women have been very hesitant to get the vaccine, which I understand. I'm a mom myself. But we see more and more data coming out now that have tied having COVID infection while pregnant linked to an increased risk of stillbirths. And so CDC just released a morbidity and mortality weekly report a couple of weeks ago, highlighting that connection and the fact that that association is even stronger once Delta came into the picture. And so I think we're seeing more evidence that not only is the vaccine safe for pregnant women, but Delta can definitely harm a pregnancy. And so that's another opportunity for a pregnant woman to talk with her OB about that and get that vaccine so that she can be protected and the baby can be protected as well going forward.
That's definitely something concerning.
Both of those studies, it looked like there was a marked risk increase with Delta as well. So again, now is the time to do that. And as you said, nearly double the risk of stillbirth, but, up to five times the risk of maternal mortality as well. And it's been shown, obviously, like other immunity or antibodies or other vaccine-induced immunity, you can transfer that on to the child for protection early in life. So
And that's a great point. Yeah. We're not going to have vaccines for babies. So it's great if the mom can transfer that over to the baby for the first few months until we have some vaccines for the younger kids.
Especially at a time like now.
Yeah. Yes. I've heard, is it true that a mother who's breastfeeding her child and gets the vaccine will pass on antibodies to her child that way?
Yes, that's often true.
That's really fascinating. And the thing that I find concerning is just how scary this virus is, especially for pregnant women. And I didn't even hear these new statistics yet about stillbirths and issues. Is there a reason why that information isn't as prominent?
You know, it's hard to guess what the media will pick up and what they will not. And you would think something like that would really scare a lot of people, like that would catch their attention. And that one kind of floated under the radar from what I saw a couple of weeks ago when that came out. And so that's something I've been trying to share with lots of people, just so that people understand that there is that connection there. You know, I can't tell you a single pregnant woman I know who has died from a vaccine, but I can tell you there have been pregnant women here in the state who have died with COVID. And that's just an unfortunate loss. You know, if you're young enough to be pregnant, that's a very young loss, period, for COVID. And then to lose the baby as well, it's just that such a sad loss a family doesn't have to endure if they go ahead and get vaccinated.
Graham, have vaccine mandates at workplaces made a difference in the number of folks getting vaccinated?
Oh, certainly. We've seen that. You know, we have a mandate at Indiana University as well. And we saw that increase pretty significantly shortly after that announcement. And it's definitely usually resulted in the workplace or at the universities or wherever, again, in that kind of low 90 to mid 90% range. It's usually about the population that you have left that seeks those exemptions. Every little bit helps, you know, just like masking, the more people that get it, the more resilient and better and safer that situation is. And so mandates do work.
I'm thinking about the flu vaccine and how sometimes companies will have a nurse come on site and give everyone free flu vaccines. I imagine it's probably difficult with some of the COVID vaccines because of the temperatures they need to be stored at. But is there anything like that where someone will come and give you the COVID vaccine at work? Is there something more convenient?
Some of these employers do that, some of the larger employers. And then also, you know, we recently worked with the state to have a mobile strike team come out with the National Guard to provide those as well. And so those are opportunities. And that might help assist with barriers to access, time off to get the vaccine. I know in the recent federal plan, too, the president's asked to give employers to give that time off to get vaccinated, to get boosters as well. And so I think it's a worthy pursuit, even if you only have a few people show up.
Well, let's talk about the federal government and what their plans are to address the variants and a winter surge. Graham, has the state announced any plans to tackle COVID this winter?
I haven't heard much new. We have our weekly call tomorrow morning, and I'm kind of curious to hear what the state says after being off last week with Thanksgiving. And, you know, there is a House bill, I think it's 1001, that's going to be on the docket in January that's kind of limiting some of the vaccine mandates. And if you have a mandate, you have to provide testing options, and employers have to pay for that testing. But that's just a proposed bill, and that's, again, in January. The State House did not come to a resolution on a few of the items that the governor wanted to end the public health emergency. So that existing emergency still exists, and it likely will into the early 22 as well. I haven't heard much in terms of the federal plan. And honestly, a lot of it's nothing new or highly innovative or different. It's a lot of the same, but I think there could have been more there as well. You know, we have these new travel restrictions that went into place today, but they're only for international travel, which seems a little silly when we have 110,000 cases per day of COVID here in the U.S. And we know that this new variant's in at least, you know, 16 or 17 states, I think it is. So, and there's no restrictions domestically, you know, and they've shortened that time frame that you have to test before you depart for travel internationally to 24 hours. But, you know, why not do rapid tests as you board the plane? You know, they're talking about expanding some of the at-home testing, or at least reimbursing that. But instead of reimbursing it, make it free. Many countries across the U.S. or sorry, across the planet, either have free rapid at-home testing available, or it's, you know, a dollar or two. I live down here in Bloomington, and it's hard for us to even find at-home kits available at times. And when we do, you know, they're $7-8 a pop at the cheapest. So I think there's a lot more maybe could have been done with that plan. I think it's time for all of us to consider better masks. Well, maybe for us to consider masks at all. Only one county in Indiana has a current indoor mask mandate. And, you know, I think between Delta and what might be coming, you know, maybe it's a time to wear an N95 or a KN95 or an FFP2 or at least a surgical mask. And those are things that, you know, I think the government could have planned and provided for. You know, here we are almost close to 2 years being into this. So mm-hmm. it was, you know, some good stuff, some helpful things, but I think we could have done a lot more and still can.
So in terms of masks, you can't just pull your shirt up over your nose when you have to go inside?
Not very effective. And again, you know, it's great. And it's maybe a little concerning when you hear people like, well, if you're still concerned, you can still wear a mask. And like, that's great, but my mask is going to work a lot better if you're in a mask. And I know, you know, people kind of attack those statements, but again, safety is not binary and more is better. And we still need to use these layered prevention strategies that we all know by now. Masking indoors, ventilation. The biggest thing I think we're seeing right now in case review is people coming to work or school or events while symptomatic. Like, don't do that. Like, get those rapid tests, utilize them. If you're having a family gathering, seen a lot of Thanksgiving transmissions. It's like, maybe you could address that by having all participants do a rapid test the day of. You know, these are the strategies that we can employ, obviously, with the number one layer still being vaccinations and boosters.
Shandy, with the federal government's plans that they announced, what are your thoughts on the steps that they're taking? I mean, because it seems like if Indiana doesn't have its mask mandate in place, there's only so much. Again, I don't know. Maybe I'm confusing things, but it seems like there's only so much the federal government can tell people to do.
Yes. And I would say that's where we're putting a lot of ownership on individuals to make the right decisions, since we don't have those mandates to use. And I agree with everything Graham just said, by the way. One point of the federal plan is to reimburse for these home test kits, which sounds great. That's fine for people with, you know, insurance who can get the insurance to help them out and things like that. But as a mom myself, I spent 90 minutes driving around the other night to try and find a home test kit for my kiddo who had not yet had his second vaccine and was symptomatic. Could not find one anywhere. Ended up getting an appointment at the testing site the next day. Had the test done. 5 days later, I'm still waiting on results. So unfortunately, numbers are going up here really fast in Indiana, and we're seeing some big delays again with some of the laboratory reports coming back to the patients and to the schools and to the health departments. And so that's very discouraging as we're trying to encourage everyone to go get tested when we still don't have a great handle on testing in this country. As Graham said, in many parts of Europe, these test kits are handed out for free on a regular basis. And so saying that we're going to reimburse someone for a test kit that they can't even access isn't super helpful. We really need to do a better job of having mass distribution of test kits, things like that, at the local level, so that when people need them, they can get them. Same thing with schools. Graham mentioned the mobile strike teams that are available from the state. They can actually go to schools now. So a school can make an individual request for a strike team to come into the school setting and do a mass vaccination clinic, which is great because especially in the rural areas, a lot of times you don't have a lot of providers who are offering the vaccines yet. So a lot of times they're still depending on the local health department to do all of the vaccines in an area. And honestly, Indiana just is not as equipped to handle that surge of people needing vaccines. We really need more help out there for some of these basic steps. So I appreciate the plan coming out and talking about how they recognize we need to do more. But I would like to see some more details and some more broad steps of what we have seen has worked in other countries. I don't think we have to reinvent the wheel here. I think there are a lot of lessons learned we could be taking from other places at this point.
Are less people going to testing sites that are supposed to be free, supposedly?
We're still seeing quite a few people go. Like I said the other day, when I was trying to get a testing appointment for my son, I was looking on the state website, and several places around central Indiana were booked 4 or 5, 6 days out. So I was having a hard time. I eventually found one. And again, now I'm assuming everyone's just overwhelmed, and it's taking me a while to get the result back. So he's better now. I do think it was a head cold. We were able to finally get a home test kit through a local health department, but I actually need, you know, a regular test to get him back in school. And so as a parent, I'm fortunate because right now I'm still working from home primarily most days. But I know a lot of families aren't in that situation. So I can see why people get so frustrated with the whole process. We're all frustrated, but we need everyone to do their part. And again, that's where the mandates come in. That's where sometimes you have to have mandates because individuals are going to get frustrated and will try and bypass the system.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with public health experts about the Omicron variant and the federal government's plan to fight COVID this winter. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're discussing the latest COVID news, the Omicron variant, and the federal government's plan to address a winter surge. We're joined by Shandy Durth, director for the Center of Public Health Practice at IUPUI's School of Public Health, and Graham McKean, assistant university director of public and environmental health at Indiana University. Before the break, we kind of touched up on testing. And what I'm wondering is, when it comes to testing, if you self-administer, how accurate is it? So is there the potential to miss cases because there isn't enough on the swab, or are these tests sensitive enough to detect what's going on, Shandy?
So that's a great question. I can say there's a lot of room for user error with these test kits. You have to really read the directions and understand what you're doing. Now, if you're symptomatic, if you have a runny nose, you've got other symptoms, then they're pretty good at picking up a positive COVID result if you actually do have COVID. Now, if you're not symptomatic, then it's just not as useful. And that's where a PCR test is really more beneficial to you. Say if you've been exposed and you're concerned, that's where I would recommend someone really seeking out a PCR test versus a home test kit. A home test kit for me last week, just as a parent, it kind of let me know just how concerned I should be. You know, because if that test kit had shown me he was positive, then I would have been just more alarmed versus as a parent just thinking my kid had the regular common cold, which, you know, we're seeing a lot of right now. Kids are all back together again. So we're seeing all of those cooties that we didn't see last year, right? We're all just concerned about COVID. And now every sniffle or sneeze, we're still worried about COVID, but we've got flu out there. We've got common colds. We've got other things out there emerging now as everyone's back together. And so the home test kit can kind of give you that peace of mind. Or if you're about to go to a big gathering, say your grandparents are there, or people you know who are not vaccinated, a lot of younger kids, and you want to just be sure before you go, it doesn't hurt to go ahead and take that home test kit before you go, just to be safe, even if you're vaccinated, just to be safe. But again, right now, it's just really hard to get those. And we're hearing from a lot of the cases that we talked to that those home test kits are hard to find around central Indiana right now.
So some of the testing that I've tried is I go to like one of those free test centers. They'll do like a rapid test first. So you'll get that within the hour. You'll get like a text, and then they'll do, you have to use the swab to swab your nose for all of this. And then you'll hear back 2 days or 2 weeks. You never know.
Yes.
And so the thing that I was just wondering, I'm always like, do I even know if I'm doing this right? Like, how far up does the Q-tip need to go? And I guess, like, how would you know if the test wasn't able to pick up anything? Is there something where they would tell you, come in and redo it?
They would only tell you to come in and redo it if they found some sort of like contamination on the sample. And so that would be unlikely. Now, if you were symptomatic and you had been in close contact and a rapid test showed that you were negative, definitely go ahead and get that PCR test, because sometimes we will see a rapid show negative and the PCR test show positive. That occasionally happens. And as far as taking a sample yourself, I thought the nurse gave us good advice the other day, because my son wanted to swab himself. And of course, I, as a mom, assumed he just wasn't going to do it well enough. He did a good job, actually. But her advice was put that swab in deep enough that you feel bone. And you could see him kind of wince and, you know, gag a little bit, because he really did a good job of doing a self swab. And so you can't just go on the outer edges of your nasal cavity. You really do have to have a complete swab in order to have a good test done for those home test kits to work well.
Oh, well, that's good advice, because I think I can say for myself, I did not touch bone. So,
yeah, it's not pleasant. So I can see why people don't do it.
Yeah. Graham, we have a question from a listener, Jeremy, on Facebook, who asks, can you talk about HIPAA and vaccines? I understand from a school nurse there is a state database of vaccinated folks that the school nurse can look up a student's vaccination status. Can I get a vaccine without being listed in the database? Shouldn't I have the right to share or not share my vaccinated status with healthcare providers of my choosing?
Well, HIPAA only covers those providers, as if I recall. I'm definitely not a lawyer, more of a public health official. And there certainly is no issue, obviously, if you self-disclose your vaccination status. But also with communicable disease, there's the communicable disease rule in Indiana. And, you know, those are things that health officials or nurses, school nurses, or other you know, contact tracers and things need to determine in order to be able to control and manage that infectious disease. So there is some, you know, wiggle room there in that regard. I don't know if Shandy has a better answer than I do on that one, but that's kind of my current knowledge.
So I can offer, I know what database they're talking about. They're talking about CHIRP, and please don't ask me to tell you the whole acronym, because I probably can't remember off the top of my head. But it is a statewide database that the state has used for probably a couple of decades at this point almost. And they do use it to track all of the immunizations across the state. It originally started just for children. Over the years, they have been adding adult immunizations into it as well. It's often used at the school nurse level too, just to see if they need to exclude a child from school if the kid's not fully immunized, that sort of thing. Because again, we've got school vaccine mandates way before COVID. We do it for lots of other vaccines. And if there's an outbreak and a child's not fully immunized, sometimes that school will not allow that child to come to school until that kid is fully immunized. So that's the whole purpose of the database. I can say, as a patient, you have the right to refuse to allow your information to go in a CHIRP. And so I know as a parent, every year I have to fill out that like mountain of paperwork every year for my kids as they start the school year. And one of those sheets of paper, if you really read that stuff, it's for that CHIRP immunization registry. And as a parent, I can say I decline to have my child's record in there. I got to say, though, I really encourage parents to let that record be in there, because that's a great record, because any healthcare provider does have that. And it's to your benefit for a healthcare provider to see that you're immunized against something. It can help them in the diagnosis of other diseases, to see when you're due for your next appointment, all sorts of things. And so I personally don't see any harm in having your providers see that you have been vaccinated. I only see it as an advantage to have a central repository of those vaccine records there. It's been a huge help to public health in many outbreaks over the years.
I have to say, I was quite surprised when I took my kids for their yearly physical, and the doctor already had that they'd gotten their COVID vaccines, even though it was done outside of the doctor's office. And I was like, wait, how do you have that? I didn't send anything. So it seems like there is a system that they're able to tap into.
Yeah, so it's that system, that it's the CHIRP system that we're discussing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Graham, when it comes to universities and what's happening with COVID protocols, what are you seeing at Indiana University right now? Are vaccine boosters the next thing that are being pushed out to educate students about?
Exactly right. We are strongly encouraging those students that are, you know, 6 months past their mRNA series or 2 months past J&J to get a booster now. And on at least the larger campuses across the state, we are offering those as well. And hope to have another clinic here announced soon before the end of the semester as well, so that students have that ability to get that before they go home. If they aren't able to do that, we definitely want them to get that booster over break as well. But the sooner the better, so we can start protecting for the holidays as well. So that's kind of where we are in that end. Most of our protocols are, you know, in place for this semester, probably in place for next semester at this point. And we still are masking indoors in classrooms and academic buildings and any public areas on campus as well.
Last year, students went on fall break, some of the students, and then ended up being virtual for the rest of that fall semester. But this year is different. Students coming back from break, resuming in-person classes. Has that translated into more spread of COVID, or have mandates been able to kind of hold that back?
Well, this year looks nothing like last year in terms of the numbers, and that is attributed to our incredibly high vaccination rate. The Bloomington campus, it's about, I think it's close to 95% or higher. Other campuses similar are just below that. And yeah, we're definitely seeing the benefits of that. Now, we are seeing, just as Indiana goes, as the nation goes, our cases kind of tend to go as well. And so we're seeing some of the biggest increases and largest cases of the semester just in this last week. And a lot of that, again, doing case review, it seems to be attributed to Thanksgiving gatherings. So as you said, last year, we kind of shut down for the year because of the concern for winter. And I think we're seeing that seasonality hitting us now nationally. But it's honestly a fraction of what we had last year. And that's, again, attributed to the wonderful vaccines that we have in place and the great vaccination rate.
I wonder if, does the weather have anything to do with anything in terms of, I feel like I saw in Florida rates were kind of going down, but in the Midwest and in colder climates, they're going up because people are indoors more. Does that seem like it's just going to be something we're going to have to deal with every year?
Yeah, I think eventually it'll fall into a pattern, but COVID hasn't done that yet. And we seem to have these kind of inexplicable 2.5 month surges, and then they waned. And I wouldn't say we reached any kind of even short-term herd immunity, maybe some type of community immunity to where that happens. Now, the reason Florida probably has some of the lowest infection rates in the U.S. right now is because they were on absolute fire early in the summer, and that was their, they were kind of the first Delta wave. So this is what you're seeing now is Delta hitting these other pockets that previously escaped that, or even, you know, in the Northeast where we had incredibly high vaccination rates early on, I think you're seeing that kind of marked decline and waning immunity. So Michigan, Minnesota, now in the Northeast, New Hampshire have the highest cases per capita. I think Indiana is now in the top 10. The state has not updated their data since the 2nd of December, so keep refreshing here. But we are seeing our highest spread now since January of 21, so 11 months ago. We could very easily be at the same level of hospitalizations today that we were in early September from the Delta surge. And I think we could easily, unfortunately, surpass the number of hospitalizations from last winter, which is just hurts me to say that. And I think it's a little more compounded right now in this winter when we have a very stressed, very tired, a very understaffed healthcare system nationally, but also in Indiana. We set a record just 2 days ago in Indiana with 70% of all staffed hospital inpatient beds currently in use, COVID and non-COVID. That's actually higher than it was during the November-December 2020 peak of the winter surge last year. So, yeah, we've got more beds available. We might have people to staff them. And that's a scary thing when we talk about providing health care to anyone for any reason. So all the more reason, I think we really need to push vaccination rates and boosters now.
Shandy, if we face a winter surge here in Indiana, how prepared do you think our state is for something like that?
I think the biggest gap that we have that we're looking at, as Graham just mentioned, is the healthcare worker shortage. Everyone is burned out. And I think at this point, they're all frustrated because people could have been vaccinated by now. Yes, we sometimes get some breakthrough cases, but for the most part, being vaccinated greatly reduces the chances that you're going to have to be in the hospital. So I think that's the biggest concern, is just not having a hospital bed and not having a hospital worker to take care of you if you go have to go into the hospital. And again, we still need to work on the testing side of things. We need to make sure that we can get those tests turned around quicker so that we have a good idea of what's going on in the community. And I just encourage everyone to go ahead and get those boosters. As Graham said, we've seen immunity wane over time. And so I know a lot of people, almost everyone in the adult categories, were eligible for vaccines by the end of May or so. And so we're at that 6 month mark. People need to go ahead and take the time to get that booster, especially before they travel for the holidays that are coming up soon.
The holidays, yeah, are right around the corner. And, you know, then there's the new year and all of that. It seems like that would be prime time spreading. So I guess what I'm wondering is, what is your advice, Graham and Shandy, for folks who might travel or go to very large gatherings in the winter because they're on break?
So, Graham, do you want to take a shot at this first?
Sure. And again, safety is not binary. This is all, there's safer things and less safe things. And obviously vaccination being number one. And the act of travel itself, I'd say, can be done pretty safely. We have a federal masking order it's pretty good compliance, I'd say, on, you know, public transportation and airlines and those kind of things. And airlines themselves have great air turnover. Ventilation is key. I would not gather with unvaccinated people unless they're children and eligible to be vaccinated at this time. And if I'm going to be around folks that are high risk, then I think everybody should have an additional shot to boost that immunity. Today is December 6th. 2 weeks from now is December 20th. So you could still have time to get that before the holiday. And it's, again, all those same things that we've done before. Now, what kind of sucks about COVID is, one, it's airborne. I don't think we talk about that enough. So, again, masking indoors and better masks. But 40% of people have no symptoms. That makes it incredibly challenging to control. And then there's pre-symptomatic spread. You know, you're infectious for about 2 days prior to your symptom onset. And so that's where I think not attending things or going places, if you have even an inkling of a symptom before you get that negative test, I think is unwise. So, you know, try to find and stock up on those rapid tests now. Now, rapid tests from a global public health kind of standpoint have some limitations in that they're not reportable. So we're not going to see that or act upon that from public health standpoint. And they might skew our picture of community transmission, but we know it's incredibly high. So employ all those levels, employ all those layers. And the more layers you can stack, the safer your holidays will be. But there shouldn't be any reason that, you know, if everybody you're hanging out with is fully vaccinated and boosted, that the holidays should be relatively safe.
Yeah, I think sometimes part of the problem is folks trying to create systems that aren't in the health sector that are like, oh, we're going to mandate that you show a card or have a negative test. But I mean, how enforceable are those kinds of things, Shandy?
So, I mean, we've seen some companies come out with some pretty good apps and things that some of the like concert venues and other places have used that are reasonable. And we know in public health, when you require a vaccination card, some people are going to cheat the system. They're going to make fake cards. That's a bad thing. It's immoral, honestly, when you're dealing with a deadly disease. But we know for the most part, if people have a vaccine card, that's a legit vaccine card. And so I think just setting out that expectation sometimes really helps, just like how you might tell your cousins you're not coming over for, you know, the Thanksgiving dinner if they refuse to be vaccinated. I think sometimes you just have to set those expectations. So I think having some of that testing requirement in place can help. Same thing with the vaccinations. That can definitely help. Again, back to the mandates. Graham mentioned, you know, airline flights. Right now, we still have a federal mask mandate, and that's great. It's another example of how when the mandates can work for us. Because just imagine if we didn't have that federal mask mandate right now, I don't think I would feel comfortable flying. I'm vaccinated, but I would not want to be on a plane with a lot of people if I got on and I saw a lot of people without a mask on. Because again, the airborne issue is just such a problem with COVID that we really need, as Graham said, multiple layers of safety. Just like driving a car, you need the brakes working, you need the seatbelt on, no drinking and driving. We need to do many different steps with COVID too to keep us safe from COVID.
I want to thank you both for taking the time today on the program. Shandy Dearth is the director of the Center of Public Health Practice at IUPUI's School of Public Health. And Graham McKean is the Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.